This hour, we've been talking about voices. And while, yes, humans are out there making a lot of noise, we are not the only creatures on the planet that vocalize. Birds, whales, frogs, toads, insects, they all make noise. But do they have a voice? And if so, what do their voices tell us about the natural world? Bernie Krause is a musician who has been recording environmental sounds all over the planet since the 1970s. He recently talked with Steve Paulson about what he's learned in his lifetime of listening.
Bernie, when I think of a voice, I think of something that humans have, maybe even something that is uniquely human, but you seem to hear different kinds of voices. What is a voice for you?
Well, actually, you make a really good point because we're so human-centric that we think of everything that we see and hear in the world as being entirely from our perspective. But a voice to me is anything that's expressed from any kind of organism or habitat.
So you would say animals have voices. I mean, whether we're talking about, you know, hearing frogs or birds, but are you saying it goes past that? I mean, is wind a kind of voice too?
Oh, it sure is. And let me describe to you what you're talking about here, because what I've done is I've taken the notion of the soundscape, meaning all of the sound that reaches our ears from any source. Well, I've taken that idea and developed it out into a number of different major sources. One of the sources is natural sound that's non-biological, like wind in the trees or waves at the ocean shore, water in a stream, that kind of thing. And that's what I call a geophony. So it's sounds of the earth that are natural sounds. And the second of these components is the biophony. That's all the organisms that create sound in a collective way that comes from natural habitats. And the third is the anthropophony, human noise. Some of it is controlled, like music and theater, and most of it is random and chaotic and incoherent. It's what we call noise.
So when you're listening to these recordings, can you only hear all of these different sounds because of the fidelity of your recording equipment, or can your natural ear just pick up a lot of these sounds?
Well, I've learned to listen very carefully. I started off as a musician, so I had some ability to be able to hear things in a discriminating way. But when I began to work in this field, it really helped me learn to hear in ways that I'd never heard before. Music doesn't even come close to teaching you that kind of discrimination. And I have to say that one of the benefits of this work is that I have a terrible case of ADHD I've had since the time I was a kid, and I still do as an older adult. And the only thing, and I'm talking about forget medication, forget therapies, and forget all that other stuff, the only thing that really helps mitigate this problem is natural sound. And I listen to it all the time.
Really? That's fascinating. You mean, so that calms you down?
Yeah. And it has a real, I'm sure that this stuff, if we do a little bit of research on it, I'm sure that this stuff would have true medical benefits if people want to do a little work on it.
Well, you mention in your book a Japanese form of healing called Shinrin-yoku, which literally means taking in the forest atmosphere.
Exactly right.
Which I love. I guess in practice that means, you know, you go out in the forest and, you know, you hang out under the canopy.
Well, exactly. And there are a number of groups that still are very closely connected to the natural world, like the Bayaka in the Central African Republic, or the Kalali in Papua New Guinea, and others as well, who, when they come in contact with the Western cash economies, the stress levels on trying to produce are so high that they really take a toll on these groups. And so finally what they do is they go away. They go away for 3 months into the forest just to listen to the sounds. And they actually heal by bathing themselves in these soundscapes, these biophonies.
Hmm. I know there is really an emerging science of this kind of soundscape that you're talking about. But I'm wondering also if there's been an issue of what to listen to. I mean, I know that, for instance, if we're trying to identify birds, often you just hear that one individual bird, and that's supposed to explain what the bird is. But I'm wondering if science is coming to a different understanding of how actually to listen.
That's also a really great question, because when I began the methodology for recording in the natural world meant that we had to go out with a very large parabolic dish and record single birds one at a time, or single mammals one at a time, or a frog or an insect. And what I realized very early on was we weren't getting very good information from this kind of reductionist, abstract, or fragmented, incoherent way of looking at the world. And so I was interested in a more holistic way of listening to the world. And I began very early recording from a more holistic perspective, recording the whole soundscape in a given habitat.
So what do these sounds tell us about our environments that we can't know if we just rely on other senses? We would be missing something that we can only understand through these kinds of soundscapes.
The whole idea of soundscape ecology has evolved from the notion that all of the collective sounds in a given healthy habitat from all the organisms that make these sounds tell us a great deal about the health and stability of that habitat. And the reason that we know that is if we take a look at a graphic illustration of sound called a spectrogram, we can actually see the discrimination of sounds, because what the animals do is they evolve in these habitats so that they establish their own bandwidth or their own niche. And the birds have one niche, the insects have another, the frogs have another niche, the mammals have another niche. And it's like television channels or radio station channels. And they all stay out of each other's way. And it's much like instruments in an orchestra. Just imagine a musical composition and you'll get the idea.
There are also similar principles operating in the ocean. And you have this incredible example of seals and magnetic signals in the lower atmosphere, and how two different species of seals 12,000 miles apart actually have similar vocalizations. Can you explain this?
Well, what I'm demonstrating here is how animals get their voices. And in this particular case, I use the illustration of thunderstorms that occur at the equator. And these thunderstorms transmit the electrical energy of the thunderstorm through the magnetic field to both poles, the North and the South Pole. And at the South Pole, there's a seal called the Weddell seal that has somehow picked up the signals of these low-frequency radio transmissions and created its vocalization based on the electrical energy of these thunderstorms, which is transmitted as a radio frequency. And they pick up these electrical signals and created their voice. Now, what's really unusual is that the Weddell seal never comes in contact with the bearded seal, which is in Alaska, the North Slope of Alaska. And the bearded seal has almost exactly the same kind of voice.
There are real-world implications to this kind of work as well. I mean, I know you've done recordings in national parks, for instance, and there's an ongoing controversy about how much human-made sound should be allowed in the national parks. How is this playing out?
My sense is that the national parks, like every place else, have to be open to a lot of different kinds of people, and they're going to come into the parks in many different ways of conveyance. Some on Harleys, straight piping their way through the valleys of Yosemite, some in RVs, some in cars that are a little bit more quiet and peaceful. And we have to just decide ourselves as a culture whether or not we want this noise. You know, there was this guy by the name of James Watt, who was Secretary of the Interior in the early 80s. He said, noise is power. And the more noisy we are as Americans, the more powerful we appear to be to others.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it does come back to that question, though, of if humans are part of nature. I mean, certainly we are. I mean, we are another animal. But then if we are making our own imprint on it, including, you know, adding all of these human-made sounds, is that maybe that's just the natural course of things?
I don't know. I'm not a good prognosticator in that sense. I don't know what the natural course of things is. I just know that we're part of it, and that if we destroy what it is that's around us, that's the very basis of our lives, there are going to be consequences for that. These biophonies are really critical for us to hear and preserve. This may be our very last chance to hear the voice of the divine.
Wow. Yeah. So one final question. What can we do to protect these natural soundscapes?
We can shut the hell up. And that's what we got to do.